Good morning, everyone. I thought we'd get underway right on time so as to maximize Barbara's time with us. And I'm very pleased to come to this point in the program because we're coming to a topic that's near and dear to my heart, which is like evidence and data and knowing what works and what doesn't and stuff like that. So I'm very enthused about this particular session. Now, as you may know, the Next Generation Learning Challenges Project has been distributing for some time now. Grants with the intent of not just catalyzing innovation at the course level, but also encouraging new strategic directions at the institutional level. A key component of the NGLC approach is gathering evidence on the impact of their projects. It is the question we all ask when hearing of such innovative undertakings. What is their impact? What was their impact? Did they truly represent an advance over the status quo? Our speaker this morning has been overseeing the impact analysis for the Wave 1 of the NGLC grants. So with us this morning is Dr. Barbara Means, who is Director, Center for Technology and Learning at SRI International. Barbara is an educational psychologist whose research focuses on ways in which technology can support students' learning of advanced skills and the revitalization of classrooms and schools. Currently, she leads SRI's research and assistive efforts in support of the national technology activities within the U.S. Department of Education. She is also directing SRI's documentation of the implementation of educational technology in schools, participating in the national randomized field trials, evaluating the effectiveness of educational technology innovations for the Institute of Education Sciences. Barbara has an A.B. in psychology with distinction from Stanford, and her PhD in educational psychology was awarded by the University of California at Berkeley. And so it is my great pleasure to welcome back to the annual meeting as a featured speaker, Dr. Barbara Means.
Thank you, Malcolm. And welcome those of you who are watching remotely. I'm delighted to be able to talk to you today about some of these results, and I look forward to hearing from you and getting some feedback on some of the ideas I'm going to talk about. I have an overly ambitious plan for today, so I'll probably start talking really fast in about 20 minutes. But here's what I hope to cover. I'm going to talk a little bit about how I think about what next generation learning is as a general concept. And then I'm going to talk about the grant program that Malcolm mentioned. That is the Next Generation Learning Challenges Wave 1 grants. And I know a number of those projects are represented in this room. We'll talk about some of our evaluation findings. And then I want to put those in some perspective by comparing those projects to things we've heard about MOOCs. And that's going to lead me to really the conceptual part of this presentation, which will be contrasting views of the nature of evidence of effectiveness and its role in learning technology research and development. And so I hope to get that far today. So we'll see. So I know there's a poll going on, an EDUCAUSE poll on what does next generation learning mean, and of course none of us has the franchise for deciding the answer, but this is my personal view, the things that I think about and I think are important. It's going to be something that better prepares students for a world that values and rewards deeper learning. And by that, I mean learning in such a way that what you learn in the classroom actually gets applied in other situations, as well as collaboration, skilled communication, and so on, those practices that we've been hearing a lot about, but as Roy pointed out yesterday, have long been important for effective functioning. It'll meet each student where he or she is and provide content, pedagogy, and access opportunities appropriate for that student, and by that I mean a visually impaired student will be able to have sound input or large font. It will capitalize on the affordances of technology for learning to do these things, and it will also, and this is going to come into my talk later, it will collect detailed data about the process of learning, not just outcomes, that can be used to diagnose student needs, to give feedback to the instructional developer as well as to the instructor, and to be combined with data from other learning systems to generate new insights for the field about learning and instruction, so it itself can become evidence. I'll talk more about that later. So the Next Generation Learning Challenges program, you've heard about their goal, that is technology solutions that can measurably improve the quality of learning experiences and students' college readiness and chances of completion. So when the NGLC funders, and this included the Gates Foundation and the Hewlett Foundation, and started working with EDUCAUSE on this, their conception was that what we have in terms of learning solutions in higher education and K-12 too, for that matter, is a really fragmented market. It doesn't work very effectively. And that this initiative might really reshape the market for learning solutions. So they really wanted to affect both the supply by increasing the supply of learning solutions, but very much working on the demand side, that is breaking down that I'm not going to use anything that wasn't invented here attitude on the part of many faculty members, and making people aware of good and effective solutions that are out there. So the feeling was that a short-term funding program that provided funds for already proven solutions could support them in scaling those solutions to more campuses. There were 29 of these Wave 1 projects in four challenge areas, which I'll mention briefly, and their original grant term was just 15 months, although many of them have applied for six-month no-cost extensions and have done that. So the four challenge areas, the first one is deeper learning. So the idea here was to promote that kind of learning that gets used in other situations, that's not just for answering questions on the class test. And part of the conception of the NGLC partnership was that a lot of this had to do with really making learning engaging for students, you know, access what they care about, build on what they know. To give an example of one of the deeper learning projects that was in the set of 29 is the U-PACE project from University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, which I think a number of you would have heard about that on Monday when Ray Fleming talked about it. So this is an introductory psychology course. It's self-paced. It's mastery-based with short modules. You don't go on until you've mastered the module, end-of-module quizzes. Timely and tailored feedback was a key part of this design, and instructor support and encouragement. A second one of the four challenges in Wave 1 was blended learning. So this could be any combination of online and teacher-led instruction, and the idea here was that it would improve learning, increase completion rates, and lower costs. An example of that program is the one at Cal State University Northridge. And this was a redesigned Gateway Math course as a hybrid alternative, if you will, and it was tied to business math course that was taught at the university. It used a number of components, including an intelligent tutor for remediation of math skills, interactive lectures with smaller portions, but these are classroom-based, and using this common set of materials across sections, facilitated group work, instant feedback on online homework, and common student assessments used across course sections, which was quite an innovation in a higher ed setting. Open core courseware was another of the challenges. These were high-quality, modular, openly licensed courseware for developmental, gateway, or high-enrollment core courses. An example of one of these projects was Project Kaleidoscope. The grant holder was Cerritos College, but it was implemented at many campuses. This was a large-scale project promoting the adoption of open education resources appropriate for students from groups that are underrepresented in among college graduates. And they developed 12 different OER courses and implemented them on 9 different campuses using textbooks from Flatword World Knowledge, Washington Open Library Project, College of Redwoods faculty, YouTube and TED Talk videos, and a variety of other resources. And then the final challenge was learning analytics, and this was the one that was not necessarily tied to specific courses. And here, this was software for the collection, analysis, and real-time use of learning data by students, instructors, and advisors to improve student success. An example of that was the Marist College Open Academics Analytics Initiative, and they developed a Sakai application programming interface to support capturing students' course effort from the Sakai event logs. And they combined this with an open source academic predictive analytics model that was based on the one John Campbell did at Purdue. So that's an example of the four challenges. You can get a sense of the variety of the projects. They were of different sizes, different foci. They were all over the place. The assumptions behind the initiative, one of them was that there are these islands of innovation, that there are good things out there that could be scaled to other institutions, but that technical and institutional barriers are what get in the way, so that by improving the marketplace through this initiative, these partnerships would be able to scale their solutions and demonstrate that they were effective not just in the home institution but also on other campuses. So effectiveness at scale was really the key goal, and there are two parts of that, of course, effective and at scale. Plan of the 29 proposals, 78 community colleges, about 73,000 students would be served during the grant period, and 200 institutions involved. To date, and all the numbers aren't in yet because, and as I said, a number of the projects have no cost extensions, you can see they're fairly close, a little bit below that goal, 73. To about 64,000. I might mention these numbers do not include many students who participated in a couple of the projects that didn't count students. It counted the number of registered users or the number of uses, and in some cases didn't know whether users were students or not students. And so they had very large numbers, but we didn't include them in this count because we didn't know that they were college students. About the participants we do know about 48% of them were from two-year colleges. The rest were four-year colleges. 40% were Pell Grant eligible of those for whom we had that data. The average course completion rate was 77%, but that reflects an average of two pretty different numbers, 93% in four-year colleges and 64% in community colleges. On the whole, there was a positive response from the instructors who were using these innovations. We surveyed them in about a year ago, those that had used them in the fall of 2011. 78% of the faculty said they would use the Wave 1 innovation they had used again. And that's, you know, that's a pretty good, if you had to take a single indicator, that's a pretty good indicator of their attitude. But we learned some things. Most of the Wave 1 innovations did not really have prior evidence of effectiveness. They had been implemented, and so they had some evidence that they were usable in most cases, but they didn't really have what an evaluator or researcher would consider evidence that people using that innovation would do better than under conventional instruction. And the other thing we found was that many of the technology components of these innovations were not really finished at the time the grants started. So they started in the spring of 2011, and the assumption was that, you know, go, you have 15 months, and you're going to have, you know, fall 2011, spring 2012. Well, what happened is many of them were still developing technology into the fall of 2011, and so they couldn't get started then. When they were implemented, the other thing we saw was when we asked the instructors what were the hard things about implementing this, the most commonly reported difficulties were technology followed by student resistance. And you can see some of the numbers here. So technology problems, some of them have to do with just, interoperability between systems. You're going to a different campus, the campus infrastructure. But a lot of it had to do with lack of ease of use or bugs in the technology solutions because they weren't very mature. So the assumption that they were ready to go was not really borne out when we looked at the data from the instructors. The second most common thing they mentioned was student resistance. And sometimes students resisted because students don't like using buggy software, nor do any of us. So that was one source. But another source was student pushback on not feeling comfortable being in charge of their own learning. That is, learning as independently as some of these solutions ask them to do. And that appears to be particularly an issue on community college campuses. The other things we asked about did not appear to be problems for significant numbers of teachers, that is, worrying about alignment with their teaching approach. They were mostly volunteer instructors, and they felt comfortable with what they were using, and they fit into the course schedule and course goals. So that was reassuring. So we found that those were the biggest implementation difficulties, but you have to remember, this was early on. For many of these, it was the first time they were implemented, and it's totally to be expected that there would be these kinds of issues in a first implementation. We did find that, as I said, the faculty were volunteers, and the projects were able to find volunteer faculty. It was the institutional relationships were much harder than finding interested faculty within an institution once you got that in place. The faculty survey responses also indicated that the faculty felt comfortable with these innovations. For the most part, they did not feel they were particularly challenging to implement. Only a few of them found that was the case. But it was interesting that those who felt the innovation pushed them to change the way they taught were the ones that were most positive about it. So that suggests that they actually liked being challenged and having to teach in a different way among this volunteer population. Now, we took from the survey a number of items and created an index of favorability that was a reliable scale, and it included their view that the course went well, that the students liked and learned from the course, and that they would use the innovation again to the same extent or a greater extent. And we found that the instructors were more favorable who had volunteered, who had attended training on the innovation, who said the innovation gave them student data and that they used it, and who said the online assessment data had affected the way they learned, and finally, who described the innovation's effect on their teaching as major, as I already mentioned. The instructors who were less favorable, you might not be surprised, they were ones who reported having larger technology challenges, a lack of alignment with their teaching approach. There weren't a lot of those, but those who felt that were less favorable. And then finally, the other barriers we talked about fitting into your class time. So some of the broader implications of these data I've talked about so far, one is that there are campus impediments to a fast start, and a number of courses couldn't get started in the fall because they couldn't get listed in time for students to register for them, for example, or they had to go through faculty senates to be approved for for administration on the campus. And lack of software readiness. Those two things meant that for these particular projects, with the goals they had, 15 months wasn't enough time. And we also saw that faculty will volunteer for such projects and that many of them want to be pushed to change their instructional practices. We also found that it was hard for them to collect evidence of effectiveness, particularly to have data on some kind of baseline or comparison group you could compare the outcomes of the students in the NGLSA using the NGLC solution to. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. Or actually, I'm going to talk about it right now. So some of the barriers, which we heard from project leaders, campus policies or institutional review boards may prohibit assigning students to courses with significant online components at random. I mean, the clearest way to get evidence of impact would be to take all the students who are going to take whatever introduction to chemistry, and you assign half of them to sections that are going to use your solution for, chemistry lab practice, and half of them are going to have conventional TA sessions. Many campus policies wouldn't allow that. Campus institutional research offices, in some cases, were not willing to release the student-level data that you would need in order to know that prior history in the course of things like completion rates and student grades were from students similar to the ones you have now. It's also difficult to get different instructors to administer the same assessment. None of these things is impossible, but it's hard, and it takes negotiation time to do all of these. And then also, for many of the project's learning objectives, there were not just valid, reliable assessments available off the shelf that you could easily pluck that was a good match to what they were trying to teach. So either they had to develop something, which then would be of unknown reliability, or have to use something that's not quite a fit. So both of these, all of these things were barriers to collecting rigorous evidence. And then the final thing I want to say, which is not a barrier per se, but I think it's important to remember that for many of these innovations, this was really the first time they were used in this form. And it's important to collect data about their effectiveness, but that doesn't mean that data is the final word. It's too early to judge something on the basis of its first implementation because it's people talk about the pancake rule. You make pancakes and the first one you put in the skillet never comes out quite right, and then you have to do the second one, and if you've got the temperature and everything right, it'll come out good. Well, the second pancake rule applies to any educational intervention of complexity I've ever known. So it's important to remember that when we talk about the student outcome data. Well, I've talked about how hard it is. I'm going to highlight a few projects that overcame the barriers and that were able to provide data about outcomes for students, about impacts. So one of them is UPACE, that University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee product. Ray Fleming talked about that at length. They were actually able to do some experimental work with random assignment of students to their intervention or using more conventional versions of courses. And they provided data to SRI, which we used to independently compute an effect size. And let me talk a little bit about that. An effect size is something, simply a standardized way of looking at the difference between a treatment group, that is those that get the NGLC solution, and a control or comparison group. It's merely the difference in their means divided by the standard deviation. So it becomes then a scale. If it's positive, that means the treatment group, the experimental group, did better than the comparison group. If it's negative, it means the comparison group, conventional instruction, did better. So that's important to remember. And the nice thing about effect sizes is that it's a standard measure, so it helps you do what our goal is to do when we get the rest of the data in from the projects that are still finishing, which is to take the effect sizes from all of the projects, and we could start looking at them together, even though they might have used different measures. As long as each project used the same measure for its treatment group and its comparison group, we can compute an effect size. Another thing to know is that effect sizes in education, if you get an effect size, you can see whether it's statistically significant, meaning that it's unlikely to have occurred by chance. But beyond that, you want to know how big it is. And when you get things that start being above 0.5, 0.6, education researchers get excited. So when you get an effect size of 0.96, as UPACE did for the percentage of students earning an A or a B in psychology, this is a strong effect. in education. That's really quite good. The completion rate, the course completion rate, and effect size of 0.35 is more common, but that's still statistically significant and a very nice effect. Now, a number of the projects weren't able to use random assignment, but they did go and pull records from institutional research offices to have something they could compare the NGLC version of the course to prior, more conventional versions of the course. Now, these aren't perfect comparisons, but it's a good place to start. One of the projects that did that was Cal State Northridge, and they had a large sample across multiple campuses, and they provided data on course grades that were received, and also they used a common, they were able to use a common assessment with common core items across across sections, and they have nice strong effect sizes for both of those. Project Kaleidoscope, this was one that, as I mentioned, was on 9 campuses, 12 different courses. Where they could, they got historical data on the last implementation of the same course by the same instructor, so they were able to control instructor. And they had a student success measure, which was a combination of course completion and grade. And we looked at this, we computed separate effect sizes for the different courses for which they had this kind of data. And you can see there were positive effects on positive effects in 3 of their courses, 2 algebra and 1 in psychology. And those were statistically significant. There was a significant negative effect in just one course, physical geography, and I don't remember how large that sample size was. It might not have been that large. There were no significant differences, although you see some effects are positive and some are negative on the other courses. But the Project Kaleidoscope, their purpose, if you'll remember, was using open educational resources to replace textbooks in these courses. And their argument is that if, in fact, you get as good a learning outcome, but students don't have to pay for textbooks, you have a value add from using the OER. And I think that's a legitimate, argument. Now, as I said, the available evidence is not, not perfect coming out of these projects, particularly the non-experimental comparisons. And I recognize this. The project directors recognize this, too. In some cases, we're pulling together things from all different kinds of projects. We're putting them together to look at average effects. The interventions are diverse. Both the technology and the practice are changing rapidly. By the time we publish these impacts, I'm sure all these interventions will have changed. Also, the underlying data from the projects, we're aware of issues. In many cases, there's a different instructor using the NGLC solution and in the comparison group. There may be multiple differences between the two, even things like who signs up for, evening sections versus who signs up for 8 a.m. Monday morning. People will tell you that makes a big difference in class performance. So students' characteristics can vary between the different section times, also between the different cohorts for one reason or another. And also an issue is when there are big differences in the number of students who stay in the class, in the online and the classroom section, that can really bias the outcome. So there are a number of issues with this, we know, but we're taking here the best available evidence, if you will. So the bottom line, I think what we're going to see is they're going to be mixed student outcomes, and that's what you'd expect. I mean, these are a lot of diverse different things. They all won't be the same. And so it will tell us that these innovations we're not all ready for scaling, and that they really probably need to go through additional iterations to really fulfill their full potential. Most of them did not require fundamental changes on the part of the higher education institutions, and the faculty did not feel they had to make major changes in the way they teach. And I already mentioned they needed more time. I think that's a realistic picture of the state of online learning and higher education today. It varies, and where we really want to go is after we bring all this data together, I hope that we'll have a big enough set of impacts that we can start to analyze what were the features of those projects that had stronger positive effects. And so what we really want to get out of this is enough data that we can start to understand why some things are more effective than others. We know there's variation, just like there's variation in regular conventional classroom instruction. Some instructors get better learning outcomes than others do. But while this NGLC wave one was going on, and remember that original kind of lofty ambition about really changing the marketplace for online education and higher education, well, what else was happening? Well, you know the answer to that, okay? Everybody's talked about it, MOOCs. So here, while we were looking at all these, if you will, incremental innovations, here was something that appeared to tear apart many of our assumptions. When Peter Norvig and Sebastian Thrun offered one of the early MOOC courses that got a lot of attention at Stanford, originally Peter said he had expected 20,000 people to register, and you know they got 160,000. All of a sudden, we had these new entities coming into the field, particularly ones that are non-academic, like Udacity, which Sebastian started, having resigned his position at Stanford, and Coursera, and huge, huge numbers of people in them. So we saw, and Roy talked about this yesterday, you know all the headlines, and there are many more. And take Coursera, for example. You know, started in July of 2012. By December, they had 33 universities, very highly elite universities, participating. Over 2.3 million people had signed up for their courses. Incredible growth, market-changing growth. What's the difference? So let's think about it a little bit. Typical MOOC features, again, these have not been defined in any strict way. The MOOCs that are out there vary probably as much as online courses do. And my impression is that this year everybody wants to have a MOOC, so the thing you would have called your online course last year is being called a MOOC. But anyway, let's think about it. Well, it's massive. And it's open, it's online, it's course. It's got to be open. That means it's available for free or very low cost. There might be some minimal registration fee. Classically, not for credit. So that's part of what took off. Designed to be usable with very large numbers of students. I think to be a real MOOC, it should be designed so that it's better when there are more students in it. Otherwise, why don't we just call it open online education? The other thing is, you know, we've talked a lot about individualizing pacing and letting students work at their own rate. That's something that was in a lot of the advocacy for online learning, its advantage. But what they did, I know what Peter and Sebastian did, is they said, no, we actually want class pacing. We want to create a cohort. So you're going to have assignments, and they're going to be due dates, just like a regular class. And they're going to be tests that are going to be due dates, just like a regular class. So think about it. MOOCs are not individualized in the way we often talk about online learning. They're class-paced. There may be parts in between that are you have individual choice of whether you do it on Tuesday or on Thursday, but that's just like a regular course. Automated scoring of student responses, because at this numbers you have to do that, and or peer grading, and I think that's something they're really working on, figuring out better ways and clever ways to do that, or to combine combinations of peer grading and some instructor oversight. some kind of mechanisms for peer-to-peer interactions. And then another thing they stressed, and I know Peter Norvig told me this, they were inspired by the Khan Academy short little video pieces on YouTube. So they would do these short pieces, which seems to be something that is in many of the MOOCs we're hearing about. So let's just reflect a minute. Why did the MOOCs take off while NGLC innovations scaled incrementally? And, you know, maybe the answers seem obvious, but I think it's worth a little reflection. One thing is, and I know edX is a an exception, but after brief incubation in a university, these organizations like Coursera and Udacity, they were launched as external organizations. They're not institutions of higher education. They were incentivized to scale their innovations to many institutions in ways that higher education institutions aren't. If it works, you know, if you've got a wonderful course and it works great for your campus, you know, really it's not the core business of the campus to spread it to other universities as most people see their core business in higher education. No small matter is, of course, they received major venture capital funding, millions of dollars, not thousands of dollars, and that enables you to buy major programming talent. They embodied a big, exciting idea, worldwide education, and hundreds of thousands of people online learning together at once. I mean, it's very compelling. I mentioned programming talent comes with dollars, and their leaders, they had some charismatic leaders with really strong PR skills. So it's not really a fair comparison in many cases. MOOCs are free and open to anyone, whereas courses that we're talking about in NGLC Wave 1 are within institutions, and you have to be accepted to that institution for a start. But also, we do need to remind ourselves that the mission is different. The MOOCs are, you want to learn, come here. That's fine. The courses we're talking about, there's the goal of completing the course and earning a college credit. And, of course, completion is where the Achilles heel of MOOCs are. And although I think it's not entirely fair, because many people never wanted to earn a credit, and they just wanted to see what a MOOC was like. But when you look at the MOOC completion rates compared to I have the NGLC Wave 1 completion data here and Achieving the Dream community colleges. You can see that the MOOCs don't look so good in terms of fulfilling the goal that was set for the NGLC project. So they really have a different goal as well as a different audience. And I think that's important to remember. But the difference in the way they're developed and the way they're evolving reflects a difference that I think has led us to think about evidence in a digital world more broadly. This is a report. It's out in draft. You can see where you can get it on the ed.gov website, evidence-framework. We did this for the Office of Educational Technology. This describes approaches to evidence gathering that capitalize on the kind of digital learning data we're going to have more and more of as more learning goes digital. It's trying to present guidance on the strengths and weaknesses of alternative kinds of data as evidence for making decisions around learning technology. And it juxtaposes two ways of thinking about what evidence of educational innovations looks like and where you get it. The one that's more familiar to those of us who are education researchers is the one that's the prevailing one in the most federal grants for education research, which is the notion that you start with a lot of early things. Those are those little droplets there. That may be a concept that you tried out in the laboratory or a classroom or two, something you think will improve learning. You then put it together in an early stage innovation, and you try it out in a classroom or two, and if it looks good, then you apply for a grant to get what they call an efficacy study. And that's where, with a lot of support in a little bit more classrooms, you do a random assignment experiment classically, and you get results. And, you know, many of them won't work, so they won't get through that filter. But a few will work, and then you do an effectiveness study. And now you try it at scale, and you do a big random assignment experiment. And very few of those have positive effects. And so down at the bottom, you get your proven innovation. Now, this model, a number of people have objections to it for not finding much that's effective in any kind of educational innovations. But looking specifically at technology-supported innovations, if you look at the Department of Education's What Works Clearinghouse that has looked for proven innovations, over more than 10 years of operation, they have found 26 technology-supported interventions that had a positive effect on one or more outcomes that met their standards over 10 years. And of those 26, 7 are no longer available because the data came from studies that were done a long time ago on things that used to be. So it's very backward-looking, not forward-looking. Okay, let's contrast this with what I think of as the tech industry R&D model, which is reflected in MOOCs. Do they talk about going through those kinds of stages? Do they start small and then just build incrementally? Is that what they did with MOOCs? Uh-uh. The tech industry talks about creating a minimally viable product, getting it out there as fast as you can to as many people as will use it. And then you start collecting data from those people who use it that you can use to improve that product. So you hear the slogan, fail early and often. Or what you see on the right there is actually a whiteboard at the Khan Academy world headquarters, which is just a little tilt-up in Mountain View. And you'll see, shipping beats perfection. That may be hard to read. Another way of saying the same thing. Get it out there, and then get real user data, which will tell you whether your assumptions in your product are good, whether it really works, what do people use, what do they not use at all, so there's no use bothering with it. And so the notion of many cycles of change and improvement at a very rapid pace is central to the high-tech view. Well, there simply is a tension between this high-tech view of getting it out there at large scale and gathering data, and what companies do and what is typical in institutions of higher education. The tradition of individual faculty developing their own course reduces interest in something that's externally developed, as many of you have found. Universities move at a stately pace. Course approval and posting policies can delay implementation, as we found in Wave 1. And if it's a course-length innovation, if you think about it, you try the course once, and then it takes you a whole term to get the outcome data, typically. And then you can try it a second time in the same year. But that's not a lot of iterations. That's not at a Silicon Valley pace. So is there some way we can get some of the benefits of both worlds? How do you resolve the tension between these two things? So, I mean, Clay Christensen argues in Disrupting Class that if you really want innovation, you're going to have to go outside the formal education system or work at the edges, the peripheries, where other people aren't working. And one example of that, I think MOOCs is one example, so it's not for course. That's not for credit. That's how they started. That's one way to go outside. Games, self-initiated games that are learning games, is another way that's getting a lot of attention. And study help systems, and I might mention, we did have one of these among the Wave 1 projects, and they had, in their 15 months, they had 130,000 registered users. Now, we don't know who they were, but we do know they had huge take-up. Another way that you can resolve this tension, I think, and I'm still trying to figure this out, and I think it has similarities to what Roy P. described yesterday morning, is collaborations among designers of new technologies, researchers, and faculty to figure out a way to conduct micro trials. Now, this is the improvement cycle. It won't be it won't be news to you. You think about it. You design something, you implement it, you measure what the outcomes are, and then analyze that data, and then you redesign it, and you do it again. I mean, we talk about that always as continuous improvement. But when you think about it, again, going back to the tech industry example, what the tech industry does is they think about doing this very, very rapidly. And the evidence framework report I mentioned describes some of the ways that they collect this kind of evidence and analyze it. And what that means is, in a given time frame, and I've hashed off, that's actually the same amount of time in both of those graphs. So instead of doing two versions of something in that time frame, they might squeeze in 5 or 50, but I couldn't get it in this slide. So if you think about, if each iteration is a refinement or an improvement, the more iterations, the more improvement in a unit of time. So that's why speed matters. And when you're not tied to a full course, you have a lot more options for rapid iteration. Another way to try to do this is to try to work with other partners so you're implementing in multiple places and trying out multiple new ideas in different places and then sharing the data. And I'll just briefly mention the Pathways Project of the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching. This is one trying to tackle the problem of developmental math and so many students never really getting out of a developmental math sequence. And here they brought together a number of different campuses with that shared problem, and they've developed a couple of different courses for doing this, and they are actually sharing data across the campuses on how students do. And so the group is examining the data both to pinpoint aspects of this course that can be improved in more iterations, but also to try to understand why does it work this way here and that way there, and how can we design something that will have good outcomes for students across the different kinds of campuses and different policies that we have. So I think this kind of collaboration and data sharing is also going to be key. And let me just finish up. We may not be quite sure what it is, but next generation learning supported by technology is coming. There's no doubt of that. And now is the time to really start stating and testing our design principles for this kind of learning. Then you ask, will it work? Well, clearly it can lead to better student outcomes. We have some nice examples from Wave 1 as well as elsewhere. But it won't always do so. We shouldn't be that surprised. Every education intervention I know about, including the ones listed on the What Works Clearinghouse, have the same issue. So what the field needs to do is get a handle on what kind of next generation online learning will work for what purposes and for what kinds of students and under what circumstances. And I think in order to do that, that means that we really are going to need to form new kinds of research collaborations across different kinds of expertise and different organizations. And for some reason, I am not able to show you. And I just finally want to say, if we don't collect credible data on next generation learning impacts, the winners in the marketplace will be those with the best PR. So think about it. Okay, thank you very much. Do we have a little time for questions, or are we? Okay. Do we have any?
I have a question from the online audience. They wanted to know if they could get a definition from you of ES, asking if it's the same as statistically significant value, or do the numbers mean something else?
Oh, yeah, no, it's it doesn't mean the same thing. An ES, it's an effect size, so it's the treatment mean minus the control mean divided by the pooled standard deviation. So it's a formula. But if you just think of it as a way of standardizing the size of the difference between the treatment and the control group, that's kind of an everyday way of thinking about it. Okay. Yeah, Stephanie.
I just wanted to thank you for your final point, actually, about the issue that we need data to make data-driven decisions. Because you're right, I think the people with the best PR and the most money are going to win. But those, as we know, in educational technology are not always winning something that lasts very long or actually does mm-hmm. what it's supposed to do. So I think that kind of people who are at this meeting are the people in the best position to really help shape that direction by saying what works on their campuses and thinking carefully about when and for whom and under what kind of circumstances. So just wanted to thank you for making that point.
Yes, thank you. And I think if we start bringing this data together across institutions and reflecting and having conversations about it across institutions, that's where we'll get the real power. Yeah. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Barbara. Thank you for all this. A great presentation. And I have a pair of related questions. You gave some sort of early signals from the emerging data from NGLC. Mm-hmm. For everyone here and listening online, can you sort of play out the timeline for how the rest of it will come and what people can expect to see? And then if you could sort of stand back from that and looking across the spectrum of what other research right now is currently available on how these new forms of learning models work, can you sort of place the body of this NGLC evidence in that context?
Ooh, that's a really good question. So the first one is easier. I'll do that. So additional projects are finishing up and submitting their outcome data in April of this year. And so we expect to have that and start computing more effect size estimates and then bringing it all together in an analysis where we try to look at the variables associated with positive effects and have a draft report in mid-August and probably something for release reasonably early in the fall of 2013. So we'll make that publicly available as soon as we can. So we're really looking forward to, and those of you who are working on no-cost extensions, one of my motives was I hope you see the importance of providing this kind of data, and you're really doing a service to the field. Both when you have positive effects and when you have no effects or negative effects, you're still doing a service to the field. And then where we place this research, I think it's really interesting because we have relatively few rigorous studies that were really experimental tests of the impacts of technology-supported interventions in higher education. There are some. They're in the journals, but they're not all full course length. In fact, most of them aren't. We have had some, but in many cases, there are some quibbles about the experimental design, of course. And in some senses, those are hothouse experiments. You know, they're set up often by an experimenter under unusual, strange conditions. I can't go into the details. So we have that. On the other hand, we have some just very general secondary analyses of students who took all courses, you know, all the courses that were taken online versus the ones that weren't taken online, and we know nothing about what kinds of courses they had online and what that meant. And this research set, I think, will really be interesting because it will be kind of in the middle. We'll know something about what the online courses, the treatment groups, we know what they were like. So we'll have deeper knowledge of that than we do in the secondary analyses. And on the other hand, compared to those experiments, where we usually know at least what the experimental treatment was like, those are often under, as I said, not normal conditions, kind of strange conditions. And I'm not sure they really generalize to the field. And I feel that our data will be more generalizable because this happened on a lot of campuses with a lot of different instructors. And so I think it'll be an important data set to the field.
Hi, Smith Barry, University of Pennsylvania. I really liked what you said about the difference between the combination or the in-between space of the stately academic pace and the rapid tech pace might be micro trials. And I wondered if you've seen any examples of successful micro trials in higher education where they've turned into a larger project.
Successful, what was?
The micro trials.
I think the closest to it, and there are some described in that evidence framework report, is some of the work actually that Carnegie Mellon has done with their Open Learning Initiative and their Pittsburgh Science of Learning Center in higher education. There also have been UCLA has applied this approach in some work they're doing in middle school math, But higher education, I would look to Carnegie Mellon. Thank you.